Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Take One. This is your host, Juan Pablo Sá, talking to you from the CITR station at UBC Point Grey campus, located in the unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. It's good to be back. Okay, yeah, it's been a very long time since I've done this show, but I'm glad to be back. I'm glad to be back here in Studio A of the CITR station. And yeah, today I've got a great episode for you guys. So Take One is back. It's been a while since it's been on the air. And I am back with a discussion about the Vancouver International Film Festival. So the Vancouver International Film Festival happened here in Vancouver, it happened here in Vancouver from the 28th of September until the 8th of October. And it was an absolutely amazing experience. I absolutely loved it. This year, just like last year, I was able to cover the film festival as a member of the press, which I really, really appreciated and I really enjoyed. But also this year, for the first time ever, I was also working for the film festival as a venue manager at International Village. So if you are a local Vancouver resident and you went to this year's Vancouver International Film Festival, if you watched any movie at International Village, odds are you might have seen me either managing the crowds or, you know, introducing a film or doing any of that fun stuff. But yeah, VIF was a great experience. You know, working for the festival was, you know, definitely really, really cool. But then I was also able to watch some amazing freaking films. In total, I saw 22 movies that screened at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. Some of those I saw before the festival even began. You know, some of the perks of being a member of the press is I was sent a bunch of screener links, which I am really thankful for. So if you are a studio or if you are someone who sent me, who sent Taekwon a screener link, I really appreciate it. Thank you so, so much. So yeah, I watched a bunch of movies before the festival even began. And then when the festival began, of course, some days I was working. But whenever I was not working, I just tried to watch as many movies as possible. That said, in today's episode, I won't be talking about the movies that I saw at this year's VIF. You know, I'll leave that for a future episode. So, you know, keep tuning in. Tuesdays in between 3 and 4 p.m., that is when Taekwon will be airing. And that is when I will be talking about the movies that I saw at this year's film festival, movies that I want to talk about, you know, random topics of discussion that I think are interesting. But today, in today's episode of Taekwon, I will actually be talking about an interview that I did for this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. So, as a member of the press, I was also able to do 3 amazing interviews. I am super thankful with everyone at VIF, everyone at MPMG, the Murray Peterson Marketing Group, and then also everyone at the NFB, and especially Katia De Bock. Thank you so, so much for believing in me and for always reaching out with cool interview opportunities. So this year, as I mentioned, I was able to interview 3 people to do 3 different interviews for this year's VIF. The first interview that I did was an interview for the National Film Board of Canada. I actually interviewed one of their filmmakers called Karsten Wall, who directed a short documentary called Modern Goose. It's a really, really interesting, really thought-provoking documentary that I very much enjoyed. It is very unconventional. It is very experimental, I guess some would say. It is an experimental documentary in the sense that there is no narration. You know, there is no narration. There is no spoon-feeding facts or information. There is no hand-holding. It is just shots of geese, shots of modern geese, as the title implies. You know, geese that have grown used to living within urban environments. And throughout the documentary, we follow these geese in their day-to-day life. You know, we see both the good and the bad, the optimistic and the pessimistic. And all throughout, we see some incredibly beautiful cinematography captured expertly by Karsten Wall. I thoroughly enjoyed Modern Goose. I would highly recommend you guys to check it out. By the way, I know this weekend it is screening at the Guelph Film Festival on the 4th of November. So if any of you guys are listening from Guelph, definitely check out Modern Goose on November 4th at the Guelph Film Festival. Modern Goose will be screening then. So yeah, that was the first interview I did. I did an interview with Karsten Wall. I did 2 other interviews. One of them was with Katie Spencer and Sarah Greenwood, the production designer and set decorator for Barbie. And then I did another interview with Sam Green, the director, you know, the filmmaker, the visionary filmmaker behind the live documentary 32 Sounds. All three interviews I very much enjoyed. But today I'm going to start by showing you guys the interview that I had with Carsten Wall, the director of Modern Goose. So first, we're going to go into a little ad break. You know, we're going to play some ads, some PSAs. But then when we come back from ad break, I will play the interview that I had with Carsten Wall. I hope you guys enjoy it. Carsten was a very insightful filmmaker. He knows a lot about his craft, and he has a very unique vision, I guess, a very unique eye for the stories that he's trying to tell. I very much enjoyed this interview. Once again, I'm very thankful to the NFB and to Katja de Bock for always supporting me and believing in the show. But yeah, anyway, without further ado, here is the short little ad break before we jump right into the interview. And here we go.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiyam Nisiyaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiyam Nisiyaya,
and the Skakuya, Talitin, who Musqueam Astail. All right, I'm gonna do it raw. I'm about to spit in this mic like freestyle elfin, you know.
Okay. Wait, hold on. Does it make sense?
No, but who cares? All right, let's go. Finally, we. You're not even gonna last. All right. Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival fountain. Just back from France. Montreal. What the f- is the script? I couldn't even. What? Victoria's pretty good, not bad festival. Fountain, back from France. What are you even saying here? Oh, you're trying to say these are the things featured in this one. You should probably specify that, because even a fucking elf couldn't understand that. Okay.
Think you can do better than an elf? At CITR, we want to have a variety of voices on the air. Want to write scripts? Do some voice acting? Broadcast your creativity? Volunteer with the CITR production department. No experience? We can also train you in everything required. Send an email to psas@citr.ca to learn more. And don't wait to get your voice on the air.
Do you want to change the state of the world? But instead you keep buying material goods to satisfy whatever desire you have in that very moment? Me too. But now you can do both! Rock Shop and Community Thrift is a local vintage shop that fulfills your 1970s alt-chic fantasy while also supporting at-risk people through their compassionate and supportive work training program. All of their profits go to the PHS Community Services Society to support ongoing healthcare, harm reduction, and health promotion projects in Vancouver and Victoria. So stop by their two locations, Community Unisex on West Hastings or Community Frock Shop on Corral Street. And if you know any other local businesses that deserve recognition for their generous business practices or their contributions to the community, please DM us on Instagram at CITR and Discorder, because we would love to spotlight them. Because hey, if you can't stop buying, you might as well start supporting.
Students of UBC, join us. Join the SSN. A collaboration between the C4 Choral Composition Club and the Music Production Club. With us, you can find someone with whom to collaborate, someone with whom to make music. All skill levels welcome. ssn@gmail.com. Reach out. Together, we can make music. Join us.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special episode of Take One. Today, I am joined by Carsten Wall, a Winnipeg-based editor who directed a TV series called The Seven Wonders of Manitoba, which won a Golden Sheaf Award at the 2020 Yorkton Film Festival. And most recently, he directed the short film Modern Goose. Modern Goose just screened at the Toronto International Film Festival and will soon screen at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. Carsten, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Hell yeah. And the second thing I'll say is congratulations. You made a short film unlike any I've seen before. The cinematography is outstanding. The editing is on point. And you can really see the work and effort you put into this film. So once again, congratulations.
Thanks a lot.
Cool. Okay, so let's jump right into the interview with the first question. I thought we should start this off with an introductory question. And the question is, can you tell us a bit about Modern Goose? What is this project and what makes it so special?
Modern Goose is my second director credit, but the first real kind of short film I have directed and shot. And it's basically a experimental-ish documentary about urban Canada geese and the challenges they face in the city, specifically the city of Winnipeg. And it's unnarrated, so that sets it apart from a lot of natural history documentaries. And there is a little bit of an experimental artistic touch to the editing and the story structure. And it's open to interpretation, a lot of it, because there's no narration. And it's really been really rewarding to see people get different messages and different emotions from it than I initially had intentioned.
That's awesome. You summed it up beautifully. Yeah, that is something that I would definitely like to highlight is, you know, just how unconventional this movie is. It is a movie that, you know, in my opinion, doesn't spoon feed you an interpretation. And, you know, it lets the viewer freely to make up their mind and, you know, interpret whatever they have to interpret. As you mentioned, there's no narration. There's no voice of God telling you how to feel. And it is very open to interpretation, which, you know, brings me to my next point, which is I've been reading reviews online for Modern Goose. And it's been very fascinating to see the different ways in which people are interpreting it. And I've seen people describing it as, you know, both hopeless and hopeful, both pessimistic and optimistic. And I guess you already answered this question kind of previously. But, you know, I'll ask it once again, is how do you feel about these different interpretations? And what do you want viewers to take away from watching this film?
Yeah, I like it that it's open to interpretation because one of my problems with natural history documentaries, which I don't like, they're great, they have their place, but one of the things that I wanted to stray away from was kind of our projection of ourselves onto the animals that we have as subjects of these films, and trying to kind of read their emotions when we really don't know a whole, like, we know animals have very complex emotions, but we obviously can't read their mind. So, I mean, I'm not the first to do this. There's been a string of documentaries lately that have taken this approach, and it's finding different ways to take this approach. And some of them lean heavily on music to guide the emotion, and some of them strip out the music entirely. So it is a pretty interesting experiment. And the end goal is really to just have a deeper connection with the animal, the audience with the animal, and especially in this film, because they're facing some issues with urban environments that, you know, in a similar way humans may understand in some ways. There's a little bit of a bridge that I'm trying to connect, and but instead of that bridge, I also want to create a wider perspective of urban environments, conflict with nature, and I don't want it to be hopeless. Obviously, there's no point. Like, it's pretty easy to make people hopeless, especially with environmental or nature films. And that's not my goal to do that. The end of the film, I hope, does bring hope and a message of nature kind of being able to take care of itself despite all the things we throw at it. It still runs on its own purpose. It has its own plan. And, that's something that the geese trust in nature's plan, and is something that maybe we should consider also.
Yeah, that's definitely fascinating. I will say you succeeded because, yeah, when I was watching the film, I definitely noticed that the movie very much walks the fine line between, you know, pessimism and optimism. And there are several scenes, very striking scenes throughout the movie that made me feel, you know, very pessimistic, very hopeless. Like, you know, the scenes where we see the geese eating the bread, which, you know, I had no idea. I don't really know that much about geese, but I did some research afterwards. And, you know, lo and behold, you shouldn't feed geese bread. And, you know, it's not healthy for them to eat the bread. So scenes like that really, you know, filled me with a certain pessimism. But then, you know, the beautiful shots that bookend the movie, you know, at the very beginning and at the very end, you know, the shots of the beautiful sunsets and the geese resting in the water and, you know, the very majestic close-ups of the feathers and their beaks and their eyes at the very beginning. And then, you know, the final shots where, you know, the geese are flying in slow motion behind the sunset. That's just, gorgeous. And it did give me a sense of hope at the end, you know, a hope for new beginnings, for, you know, to quote Jurassic Park, you know, for life to find a way, I guess. And yeah, I definitely think you succeeded. You walked that fine line beautifully. And, you know, speaking of all of those very striking visuals and all of those very striking moments, that brings me to my next question, which is, you know, the movie ends with a title card stating that you observed and photographed geese for 18 months in order to make this movie. What inspired you to do this? And what inspired you to make this film? And I guess a subsequent question would be, out of all animals, why did you pick geese?
Yeah, it's not a super interesting answer, but basically my first nature series that you mentioned, The Seven Wonders of Manitoba, was pretty standard, formulaic. And I wanted to do something a little different, a little higher budget, but I knew I wasn't going to get, let's say, a Planet Earth budget or a budget to go up north and film polar bears or caribou. So that limited my scope to animals that I can easily access in my backyard. And it basically made me narrow down different urban animals. I started with pigeons, and I started just trying to, when I was making the pitch for the film, I would walk to the areas of Winnipeg where pigeons like to eat. They eat grain from the grain trains that go by. And I noticed a bunch of geese kind of like fighting them for the grain. And I was like, well, this is kind of interesting because the geese, they leave and they come back. But they do, even though that they migrate in Winnipeg, they still are pretty much, they have a lot of adaptations to this environment. And it made it, once I kind of just started thinking about them as my subject and doing some research, I started to realize that they kind of represent a very interesting time in the natural world versus the human world right now, where we've created these very manicured environments like the suburbs that we've littered with green spaces and water to make urban life more tolerable for ourselves. And in return, we have all kinds of animals moving in because it's a perfect environment for them too. And realizing that, and realizing that the clash between the geese's instinct versus the convenience of habituating, but also the dangers of habituating to the urban world, that it had a lot of layers of meaning that I wanted to explore. And I'm still planning to make a film about pigeons, but it's a totally different project.
That's amazing. Yeah, thank you for the answer. You know, just a little side note, a little side story, I guess. I'm not familiar with geese, as I mentioned. I'm from Colombia, from South America, so, you know, geese don't frequent my country, I guess. That said, I do have a couple of friends here in Canada who are from Manitoba. So, you know, as soon as I heard about your short film and as soon as I watched it, you know, I reached out to them and I told them, like, hey, I'm going to be interviewing this filmmaker from Manitoba who made a short film about geese. And their first reaction from both of them was, why? Geese are scary, angry, and you should keep away from them. You know, you should keep your distance, I guess. So, you know, I thought that was pretty funny. But, you know, I definitely think you were able to capture them very up close. You know, everything I've heard from geese is very negative, and the fact that you were able to get so close and personal to many of them, amazing.
Well, they're a very polarizing animal, and most people do have a bit of a fear of them because they've been there's some misconception about their territorial nature. But then we also have a lot of migration bird viewing events here in Manitoba, which is, it's quite spectacular to see them all migrate at the same time. So we kind of have this love-hate relationship with them, which also has a lot of layers about how we view wildlife. If it's inconvenient for us, we hate them. But if it's cute and cuddly and looks beautiful, then we love them. And that's not really those boxes. Nature doesn't really fit into those boxes all the time. So
amazing. Okay, that brings me to my next question, which is, you know, how did you craft the story of Modern Goose? You know, was this story something that you planned beforehand? Was it something that you molded while you were shooting? You know, you molded it by the geese and their actions while you were filming them. Or was the story something that just came to you while you were editing the film?
No, I definitely had a guide for my storyline in place because I realized early on I could just film the geese and they would do nothing but eat and poop. And that's all my footage would be because that's literally what they do for most of their day.
Sounds like a great documentary, the sequel mayhaps.
So I started to think about kind of how they interact with different areas of town, the suburbs versus the downtown versus the wetlands outside of the city, and kind of their journey through the city, and then kind of putting that against a small B story of water and the environment and how water flows and gets polluted and it runs off from the suburbs to the river downtown. And then as soon as I picked out the kind of neighborhoods or the areas of town I wanted to focus on, and then there was a lot of sitting around waiting for the geese to do something, but I did capture early on the bread sequence you mentioned, and that was a very strange, I didn't know why there was bread by the river there. I didn't know really what was going on, but I knew it was a scene that a lot was happening, and it was good to get that early on because it was easy to create a storyline on both ends of that and be like, okay, this is probably the 3/4 part. I don't know about climax, but it's like it's an important turning point in the film, so I'm gonna build off of it, and then that was helpful. Although the storyline, my first assembly was 2 hours long. There was a lot more going on in my head, and a lot more characters, human characters, and a lot more stuff happened. So the NFB was really helpful in giving me these hard time limits and giving me notes on, you know, certain things overstay their welcome in the film that it's sometimes hard for a director to see those things. And process of elimination, but keeping the same arc. The arc pretty much stayed more or less the same. Also with the beginning and end, the bookend, that was something that I knew I wanted early on. And the magnetic field that the geese visualized, that visual effect that I have in there, that was another thing I knew I wanted early on. So that also helped. So I had the beginning and end and then a middle part. So it's kind of like I always approach editing as like a puzzle where you start with the end pieces, but you also start with some of the middle that you know exists. Like if you're doing like a jigsaw puzzle, you see the sky part or whatever, like, or all one color. It's kind of how I approach editing, where I know some things will work and then I build and try to complement them on either ends. And I can do that because I was filming also. I could edit, film, and make sure that I'm not missing any pieces. So I was like filming right up to the end of the edit. So,
I mean, yeah, that was extremely insightful. Thank you so much. I mean, as someone who's, you know, dabbling with filmmaking myself, you know, I've made a couple of short films. I haven't tried my hands at documentary filmmaking, but you know, it is definitely something that is itching in my head. And this was extremely helpful. Thank you so much. And okay, that brings me to my next question, which is, you know, more related to editing. And, you know, before you directed these different documentaries, you were an editor for several nature documentaries. You know, you edited for Polar Bear Town, March of the Polar Bears, Great Lakes Untamed, and, you know, many, many more. And my question now is, how did this editing background inform your filmmaking when making Modern Goose?
It was kind of, in some ways, it hindered me a little bit because I was kind of stuck. I've worked mostly in television, and there's a really structured act, like act by act work process that you do, and you always have a cliffhanger at the end of an act. It's the old TV, it's the old TV format, and I really needed to break out of that mindset. It actually was quite difficult to break out of that mindset. But my Seven Wonders of Manitoba project did teach me that, you know, you got to shoot a ton in any nature film. You got to shoot lots, but you also have to really organize that footage, because if you shoot something great and it gets lost in the mountain of footage that you got, it's almost like you never shot it at all. So a lot of my time in the edit suite was going through every single shot and flagging and logging the ones and the potential they had for scenes. And I had to do that multiple times. And I had like 10, I have like 20 terabytes of footage, or 30. I don't even know how much. I had an insane amount of footage. I mean, I shot a lot of slow-mo, so it wasn't like it was a lot bigger than it should have been. But there was a ton of footage that, in any editing project I take on, I need to know the footage like the back of my hand, because right up until the end, you will remember a shot. Excuse me. Right up until the end, you will remember a shot that you need to have cataloged in your brain, and then you need to have it easily accessed in the database. And so that really helped me. I've made a lot of mistakes in my editing career as far as losing footage and getting lost in my own footage. So it was helpful and a hindrance. Yeah, trying to break out of that rigid format and do something a little more artistic. I really struggled with that.
That's awesome. Thank you. Okay, I guess the next question I have would be, you know, your film has been described in a variety of different ways. You know, the NFB website describes it as a film essay or as a nature film, but the CBC and TIFF describe it as a documentary. Would you describe Modern Goose as a documentary?
Yeah, I think I would, because it is not like, I take some liberties with some visual effects and stuff, but for 99% of it is stuff I captured in the field. And my experience with nature documentaries, I do know that nothing ever, especially with nature films, nothing plays out how it, like, some of it plays out how it really went, but you will do a lot of, you'll take a lot of liberties in editing different animals together. Like, when I work on polar bear documentaries, they're definitely cutting between different, even male and female polar bears, trying to say it's the same polar bear. So, like, it's a thing with nature films. It's just so hard to an animal's not an actor, so to create a storyline sometimes can be a challenge. So I would say it is a documentary, a natural history documentary. Some parts maybe a little more authentic than a regular natural history documentary, and some parts a little more artistic and unconventional, but definitely it's all based in reality.
Hell yeah. No, I mean, I agree. Actually, when I was writing this question, I was reminded of a class I took here in university at UBC. That was a seminar in documentary filmmaking. And, you know, one of the big documentarians that we studied was, you know, John Grierson, who coincidentally is also the founder of the NFB. And, you know, in 1939, when he founded the NFB, he described documentaries as the creative treatment of actuality. And, you know, I think your film definitely fits into that mold. And you definitely treated actuality in a very creative way. So I would definitely agree.
It's a really nice compliment.
Thank you. You made an amazing film, and you let me watch it and interview you, so thank you. I think we're kind of running out of time, so, you know, let's go through the last few questions. The penultimate question that I have for you is, you know, speaking of the creation of the NFB, in 1939, the National Film Board of Canada was established with the mandate, interpret Canada to Canadians and the world. Modern Goose, as you've mentioned, was produced by the National Film Board of Canada, the NFB. So my question to you is, how does Modern Goose interpret Canada to Canadians and the world? And more specifically, how does it interpret Winnipeg in particular to Canadians and the world?
Yeah, I'll try to answer this quickly. I mean, the fact that it is a Canada, the species is the Canada goose, and the history of the Canada goose, it's not stated in the film, but there's underlying undercurrents of it that they were, in the 1950s, they were hunted almost to extinction. And then in the 1970s, we started creating the suburbs, and it happened to be the perfect environment for them to flourish. So now we have a quote-unquote population problem with them, and take measures to limit their population. So in a lot of ways, it mirrors our second half of the 20th century, just the story of the geese. It kind of has some very subtle similarities to Canada's experience with the wilderness, and kind of in a deeper way, it kind of does expose our contradictory relationship to the natural world here in Canada, where we like the natural world to be convenient for us, and we extract an immense amount of wealth from it, but we also a little hypocritically say that we have this vast untouched wilderness that a lot of our iconography is, you know, mountains and rivers and the wild north and stuff like that, when reality we really have this dual relationship with nature that there's a lot of stuff there that I can't really fully get into, but I feel like the geese is just a small example of that. And Winnipeg specifically, I mean, Winnipeg fits in with other prairie cities such as Saskatoon, Regina, Calgary, Edmonton, in the fact that they are surrounded by farmland and they really let suburbia take over and really take over the city in a lot of ways. And I've seen some reviews that say this film was great, but I really don't want to visit Winnipeg. I didn't mean to do that, but it is the nature of prairie cities where we create these really, really, in my opinion, ugly, ugly suburbs. And they're kind of an affront to nature, where we have like fake fountains and fake and golf courses. And to me, I hate it, and I wanted to expose the ugliness of it, and I didn't have to try too hard because it is pretty damn ugly on the outskirts of any of these towns. Sorry to people in the suburbs, but that's just how I feel about that. But I didn't set out to make Winnipeg look bad. I thought some parts of it looked beautiful, but I mean, the main goal for me was to have the wetlands environment shine through, because that's another, with these prairie cities, that's another thing that I wanted to touch on, is that we do just bulldoze so many beautiful wetlands that are so important to cleaning the environment and cleaning the water. And then we replace them with really kind of just flood management, especially in Winnipeg, with these ditches and irrigation. And then what we have is this really polluted water system that Lake Winnipeg has got a huge pollution problem that could be solved by the protection of wetlands. So I wanted to focus and try to show some of the beauty of the wetlands and how important they are, and how nature is really, like, if you want to experience nature in one of its purest forms, going to a wetland preserve is one of the best ways, I think.
That's amazing. Thank you. Great answer. Okay, real quick, the last question I have for you is a question that I usually ask, you know, the different interviewees that come on the show. It is a more personal question, but the question is, what is your favorite film? And if you don't have a favorite film, what is the first one that comes to mind?
I mean, I don't have a favorite film, but I do really like the documentary eras of the late 90s, early 2000s. And NFB has two really amazing documentaries from, I would consider, that era. And one is called Carts of Darkness, and the other one is called Weebo's War. And I know you can watch Carts of Darkness on YouTube. I think Weebo's War you have to purchase to watch, but both are very good films and very good examples of really well-crafted documentaries. The reason why I like that era of documentary filmmaking is because the filmmakers really dedicated years and years and years to their subjects and just were extremely patient to let the stories unfold and the characters develop. And I feel like in the era of quick, fast YouTube documentaries, that is completely mostly lost. And it's a shame. But the nice thing is organizations like the NFB preserve these films and preserve these moments in Canadian film history, and you can go back and watch them.
Agreed. No, that is awesome. Thank you so much for the recommendations. I'll definitely add them to the watch list. The interview has come to an end. So, Carsten, once again, thank you so much for joining us for this interview. To the viewers at home who are watching this right now, definitely check out Modern Goose either at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival or somewhere down the line whenever it becomes available. Once again, thank you so much for watching and thank you so much for joining us, Carsten.
Thanks so much.
Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% Indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or Grocery Checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek Coffee today.
And welcome back to Take One. This is your host, Juan Pablo Sá, talking to you from CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Okay, I hope you guys enjoyed that interview. Once again, that what you just listened to was an interview with Carsten Wall, filmmaker who just recently made a documentary, a short documentary called Modern Goose, a very experimental, very novel, very innovative, very thought-provoking documentary with beautiful cinematography about modern geese. And, you know, geese living in day-to-day life and coexisting with humans. Henceforth, why it is called Modern Goose. That was one of the three interviews that I did for this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. As I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, I also did two other interviews, one of them with the production designer and set decorator for Barbie. Barbie, the highest grossing movie of the year so far. It was an amazing interview. And then I also did an interview with the visionary, incredible filmmaker behind the live documentary 32 Sounds. I loved all three documentaries I did for this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. Definitely stay tuned. And once again, Tuesdays from 3 to 4 p.m., that is when Take One is going to go live. And you guys can catch me either playing some of the other interviews that I did with, you know, the other people that I just mentioned, or potentially reviewing some of the movies that I watched during this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. As I mentioned at the top, I watched 22 films at this year's festival. And yeah, there is a lot to review. I guess if you guys are itching and really want to know what I thought of this year's Vancouver International Film Festival and can't wait to future episodes, I guess the best way to do that would be follow me on Letterboxd. You can find me on my name, Juan Pablo Sá. And then there I have a list where I have ranked every single film that I saw at this year's Vancouver International Film Festival. Anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed that interview, that Modern Goose interview with Carsten Wall. But now, in the last 20 minutes of this episode, there is something that I have to address, and that is the fact that today is Halloween. Today is Halloween, so happy Halloween. I hope you guys have some fun plans for the rest of the day. I hope you guys have some fun plans for the night. If you're going trick-or-treating or if you're doing something else, I hope you have fun. I hope you have a great costume in mind. It should be fun. It's a fun day. So, you know, I hope you guys are ready for some fun. But anyway, considering that today is October 31st, I figured, you know, we might as well get a little spooky in here. You know, we might as well talk about some horror movies, some horror stuff. And I figured I would share with you guys some of my favorite horror movies of all time. But before I do that, let me set the tone. And I will set the tone by playing a song that in my mind is synonymous with Halloween, okay? When I think of Halloween, there are a few songs that come to mind before This Is Halloween from A Nightmare Before Christmas. And I know, A Nightmare Before Christmas isn't technically a Halloween movie, in my opinion. You know, after all, it is called A Nightmare Before Christmas, and the whole movie revolves around Christmas. That said, the opening song, you know, the song that opens the entire movie, This Is Halloween, is very much, you know, has become an icon for the season, an icon for Halloween. And, you know, Nightmare Before Christmas is a movie that I personally really adore. I think it's an incredible film. I know it's not directed by Tim Burton, but it, you know, it does have his fingerprints all over the film. I love the creatures. I love the story. I love the songs. I love the music. I love the atmosphere. I love the sense of wonder and whimsy that the film produces. It is a very simple narrative. It is a very simple, straightforward story. But I love it. And I loved, especially from The Nightmare Before Christmas, I love the way in which Henry Selick, I think that's the name of the director, yes, the way in which Henry Selick and Tim Burton basically flipped the claymation expectations on their head. You know, up to this point, I might be mistaken, but up to this point, claymation was most famously used for Christmas animated films, you know, particularly Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and Frosty the Snowman, and, you know, a bunch of others. Claymation and stop-motion animation was associated with wholesomeness, with nice things, with pretty Christmas cozy stuff. And of course, it was very much associated with Christmas. So I love the fact that back in the 90s, I think that's when the movie was made. I am not really sure. I'll double check that. But, you know, back in the 90s, when they were making Nightmare Before Christmas, they basically flipped the expectations for claymation on their head. You know, they did a claymation, they did a stop motion animated film, but now it wasn't wholesome, it wasn't nice, it wasn't cozy, it was spooky, you know, it was all about ghouls and this horrible, creepy creatures, and it was not about Christmas, it was about, well, Halloween Town, but, you know, it is kind of about Christmas, so this movie lives somewhere in between. But anyway, without further ado, here is This Is Halloween from Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas. Oh, there appears to be a problem. Give me 1 second. Let's see if it works now. Ah, there you go. This is Halloween.
Spiders in my hair.
This is Halloween, this is Halloween, 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 Halloween.
In this town we call home, everyone hail to the pumpkin song.
In this town, don't we love it now? Everybody's waiting for the next surprise.
Down that corner and hiding in the trash can, something's waiting on a punch and pound.
Hooray, this is Halloween.
Red and black.
And slightly green.
Aren't you scared?
Well, that's just fine.
Say it once, say it twice, take a chance and roll the dice. Ride with the moon in the dead of night.
Everybody scream, everybody scream.
In the town of Halloween.
I am the clown with the tearaway face.
Here in a flash and gone with a trace.
I am the who in the cold who's there.
I am the wind blowing through your hair.
I am the shadow on the moon at night, filling your dreams to the brim with fright.
This is Halloween, this is Halloween, 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 Halloween.
Candelabras everywhere, life's no fun without a good scare.
that's our job.
But we're not mean
in our town of Halloween.
In this town, don't we love it now? Everyone's waiting for the next surprise.
Skeleton Jack might catch you in the back and scream like a bat. You make you jump out of your skin.
This is Halloween, everybody scream.
Won't you please make way for a very special guy?
Wildman Jack is king of the pumpkin patch. Everyone fails, you are pumpkin king. Now this is Halloween. This is Halloween, 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 Halloween.
This town we call home. Everyone hail to the pumpkin song.
This is the boy, Jacuzzi LaFleur. You here with Crimes and Treasons Radio. Jazz Cartier, y'all know who it is. Golden Child, baby, let's get it.
Hey! What up? This is Machine Gun Kelly, and right now I am tuned in to Crimes and Treasons, goddammit.
Hey, what is up, Isaiah Rashad?
Crimes and Treasons, this is your boy, Just Blaze.
Yo, 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 what's good? It's Bodega Bams, a.k.a. Poppy, a.k.a. Young Don Francisco.
Hey, yo, it's Baby No Money.
What's good, y'all? It's your boy, Terrell Safady.
Hey, what's up? It's Tion Kidd.
What up? This is Stango.
And this is your boy, Waldo.
And you're listening to Crimes and Treasons Radio.
Yeah, bitch.
What's up? This is Peanut Butter Wolf. You're listening to Crimes and Treason Radio.
Hello, this is Blowfly.
Hey, this is Halo.
Hey, what's up? It's St. John, and you're not listening to Crimes and Treasons. It's lit.
Hey, y'all know who it is, man. It's your boy, Sahara the Prince.
Yo, what up, though? This is Ill Tone from Blacktivity.
Yo, peace, family. It's your Guala Dizzy Rice.
Yo, this is Remy Wolf.
Hey!
Yo, what's poppin', man? It's I Am Super.
This is Jay Worthy, a.k.a. P Worthy.
Hey, yo, you already know what time it is. It's your boy, ASAP Yams, a.k.a. Yamborghini, a.k.a. Lil Newport, a.k.a. motherfucking. I got too many motherfucking aliases, but you already know what time it is. Crime and treason in this motherfucker. Shout out to these motherfuckers. They putting it down with that real trill shit.
Yo. It's Camp Blow Out.
Crimes and treasons. That's what we believe in while we blowing the treason.
Crooks out.
Tune in to Vancouver's Rap Radio Show every Tuesday, 8 to 10 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Okay, let's see here. Blend equal parts science and stories. Add a few shakes of music and soundscape, and wrap it all up in a big question. How can we see this more than human world in a new light and take part in shaping a healthy Anthropocene? Catch Future Ecologies every Sunday at 8 a.m. on CITR.
Welcome back to Take One. This is your host, Juan Pablo Sá, talking to you from CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Okay, I hope you all enjoyed that song. Of course, this is Halloween from The Nightmare Before Christmas, and I'm playing that song because today is Halloween. Today is October 31st. But anyway, we only have like 10 more minutes of the show, so I'll make this quick. You know, I have many more horror movies that I would love to talk to you guys about or to recommend, but you know, we don't have that much time, so I'll make it quick, and I'll just tell you about my top 10 horror movies of all time, okay? I'm not like the biggest horror junkie. There are definitely many more horror movies that I need to check out, and I haven't looked at this list in a while. So, you know, some of my rankings might have changed. I don't know, but, you know, this is the way I have it currently. This is my current top 10 horror movies of all time. And let's begin with number 10. The first movie that I would like to talk about is The Witch. And yeah, that is 2015's Robert Eggers' The Witch. It is just an incredible folk horror with some amazing performances, with some great tension being built. And I love this horror. That, you know, this horror film is what some people call elevated horror, in the sense that, you know, it is very thought-provoking, it is very artistic, it has a slower pace, it is more of a slow burn, it doesn't rely on jump scares. Instead, it creates an eerie, creepy atmosphere. It is a great character study, and, you know, the film as a whole, you know, serves as commentary, you know, social commentary on the way women were treated back in the day. You know, the way that women were labeled as witches when they were trying to just simply be independent. And I think this is a fantastic movie. I think Black Phillip is incredibly scary and intimidating, even though he's just a goat. I think the buildup of tension in this film is incredible. And once again, the atmosphere in The Witch is amazing. I think, yeah, I don't think this is my favorite Robert Eggers film, but it is an amazing horror movie that I would highly, highly recommend. Anyway, so that was my number 10. Then my number 9 would have to be David Cronenberg's The Fly. I mean, come on. This is just I think this is one of the quintessential examples of sci-fi and horror coming together to create a beautiful, beautiful thing. The performances are incredible. The special effects are absolutely amazing. You know, when Jeff Goldblum's character starts turning into the, what's its name? How is it called? The Brundle Fly, the Grundle Fly, the Brundy Fly? I don't remember. But when his transformation begins, the special effects are great. The tension is incredible. The dream sequences, I think, add a lot to the movie. The ending is amazing. And the way the whole movie is just like this modern retelling of, you know, Kafka's, I'm blanking on the title of the book, but you know what I'm talking about. You know, the book written by Kafka about the guy, Gregory, I don't know, I read it in Spanish. The guy that slowly turns into a bug, you know, that turns into a cockroach. So, I love The Fly. That is my number 9. Then my number 8, The Shining. Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. I mean, come on, it's Stanley Kubrick. Of course I have to put The Shining in my top 10. This is a movie that freaked me out when I was a child. The visuals are incredible. The way the film uses sound is amazing. Once again, the atmosphere, the sense of dread, and then also the way in which Stanley Kubrick mixes not only horror, but also comedy. You know, there are some moments in The Shining where you don't know if you should laugh or if you should be afraid. For instance, the best example is when Jack Nicholson's character's wife, when she sees the room with the guy dressed like a bear and then the other guy, and it's weird and it's creepy, but it's also kind of funny, but it's also kind of scary. I mean, The Shining is as iconic as a horror movie gets. The theme is incredible. The sounds are amazing. The visuals are amazing. The performances are absolutely incredible. Jack Nicholson's performance is one for the history books. So The Shining is my number 8. Then my number 7, I would put M. Night Shyamalan's The Sixth Sense. I won't say much about this film, but I think this film might be one of my favorite plot twists of all time. I won't spoil it just in case, even though pretty much everyone got it spoiled already, but it's an amazing plot twist. It's an amazing slow burn. And by the end of the movie, you're going to be like, oh my god, yes, this was 100% worth it. Then number 6, John Carpenter's The Thing. I freaking adore this movie. You know, it's claustrophobic, a bunch of characters locked in one location. They can't trust each other because any of them could be the thing. And, you know, I mentioned practical effects in The Fly. The practical effects in The Thing are just even more impressive. It's absolutely insane. It's tense. The tension keeps building. It's suspenseful. It is scary. It is always interesting. You're always on the edge of your seat. And the ending of The Thing is just beautifully ambiguous in the best way possible. Then my number 5 is Hereditary, Ari Aster's first feature-length film. I freaking adore Hereditary. I think to this day it is still my number 1 A24 movie, my favorite A24 movie ever. I adore this film, the pacing, the performances. Toni Collette deserved an Oscar. Oh my god, she was absolutely incredible. It is iconic, it is unpredictable, it is scary, it is spooky. This is a movie that keeps ramping up the intensity and keeps building up tension more and more, but it rarely lets you release that tension. It keeps you wound up like a yo-yo for the entirety of the film. I love it. Adore Hereditary. Then my number 4 is Jaws, Steven Spielberg's Jaws. this is just one of the best horror movies of all time, one of the best monster movies of all time. What Spielberg did with the camera and with music, what John Williams did with that score is just, come on. This, Jaws, is one of the greatest movies of all time. I absolutely adore this film. Incredible. If you haven't seen it, definitely check it out. Then my number three is Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. Equally iconic, amazing film. I mean, everyone knows the shower scene where, you know, I won't spoil it just in case, but where the silhouette of the old woman stabs the young lady in the bathtub. I love Psycho. It lives up to the hype. I remember when I saw it, I didn't think I was going to enjoy it because I was like, come on. I mean, this is old. It's black and white. How is it going to be scary? How is it going to be interesting? But oh my God, there is a reason why Alfred Hitchcock is a master of suspense. Psycho is a masterpiece. Then my number two has to be The Exorcist. William Friedkin's The Exorcist. It is just one of the best movies I've ever seen. It is an incredible Manichaean struggle in between good and evil. The forces of good versus the forces of evil. The plot twist, the story progression, the way intensity keeps ramping up. The lead performance from Linda Blair, the way she acts when she's possessed by this demon is amazing. The visuals are iconic. And then, you know, the final showdown in between both priests and the demon inside Linda Blair's body is just... it's just cinema gold, man. It's just cinema perfection. And then my number one, my favorite horror movie of all time, has to be Ridley Scott's Alien. It's amazing. It's freaking incredible. For my money, the best creature design of all time is the Xenomorph in the Alien movies. And the way they build up tension, the claustrophobia, the atmosphere, the story, the implications, everything in Alien is just firing on all cylinders. And apart from that, you know, horror of, oh, you know, there's a killer amongst us and he's killing us one by one. There's also that Lovecraftian horror that, you know, there's something bigger than us that we can't control. There's something bigger than us, a primordial being that is killing us one by one. So anyway, those are my top 10 horror movies of all time at this point. I love those movies. Definitely check them out. But now, before I go, I will end this episode by playing another song that is very tied to Halloween, at least for me. And this song is a song from another Disney movie, not The Nightmare Before Christmas, but when I was a child, I used to be very scared. I used to be scared very easily. And I didn't watch many horror movies growing up, but there was one movie that I did rewatch over and over again every October 31st, and that was The Adventures of Ichabod and Mr. Toad. I always skipped the Mr. Toad part, but oh my God, the Ichabod part, the story of the Headless Horseman is just, it genuinely is some of the best stuff Disney has made. I absolutely loved it, and if you haven't seen it, definitely check it out. It is a more child-friendly, but equally spooky and incredibly well-made animated short film about the story of the Headless Horseman. And in that short film, there is this song that the characters sing right before the Headless Horseman appears. This is a song that basically builds up the tension, that starts creating suspense, that starts getting viewers spooked about the Headless Horseman. And not only viewers, but the main character as well, Ichabod Crane. Here is the song.
Late. Van Tassel always called upon his guests to tell him ghostly tales of Halloween. And Bram knew there was no more firm, potent believer in spooks and goblins than Ichabod Crane.
Just gather round and I'll elucidate on what goes on outside when it gets late.
Long about midnight, the ghosts and banshees, they get together for their nightly jamboree. There's things with horns and saucer eyes, some with fangs about this size.
Some are fat, and some are thin.
And some don't even wear their skin.
Oh, I'm telling you, brother, it's a frightful sight to see what goes on Halloween night. When spooks have a midnight jamboree, they break it up with fiendish glee. Ghosts are bad, but the one that's cursed is...